This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're a birder, you probably got a bunch of tricks up your sleeve to help in identifying a bird. Its color, its size, where you see it, how it moves, of course, its song. Now imagine that you're tasked with identifying birds in flight high over your house, but in the middle of the night where you can't see them. How would you do that? Well, a group of researchers at New York University and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology are tackling that challenge by teaching a computer to recognize their voices. SciFri's Charles Berquist visited their project to find out how it's done. Here's Andrew Farnsworth of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and Justin Salomon of NYU.
This is what fall migration sounds like. A veery, scarlet tanager, and a large chorus of the Swainson's thrushes. We may not know what a computer finds valuable in terms of the measurements. We want to make as many different kinds of measurements as we can, but that intro point to go from human to computer is really about thinking about these sounds and frequency and time, and then figuring out how to measure in increasing detail, and then feed all of that information into the machine listening models.
On the sensors, there is a spectral template detector that scans the audio as it comes in, checking for potential matches. When a potential match is identified, it snips roughly 1 second of that audio centered around the detection and sends that to the server.
Flight calls are very distinct from bird song. Bird song is made up of lots of different notes strung together, lots of syllables. These flight calls are single notes, all almost exclusively less than 100 milliseconds. Humans clue into what's the frequency, how does that frequency change in time, what's the quality of the signal, is it burry sounding, does it warble at all, is there a modulation in it, or is it pure, is it an upsweep or a downsweep, ascending in frequency or descending. Those sorts of things are some of the first bits that we clue into that then we try to translate into actual measurements.
The way we then teach the machine to recognize these is by giving it a large collection of these recordings, and we actually use what's called unsupervised feature learning, which means that we don't have to tell the model what to look for. Rather, by giving it a large number of examples, the model builds a statistical representation of the specific patterns that are representative of a certain species.
Many, many birds migrate at night, many species. The only way to identify the species that are migrating at night is to use these flight calls. So the eventual goal is really to be able to put names on these things at night that we would not otherwise be able to identify, and do that in an automated way in real time, where we could get information both to do good science, to understand the biology, the acoustic communication here, and also to apply it to conservation.
That was Andrew Farnsworth of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and Justin Salomon of NYU. They're both part of the BirdVox project. And joining me now is Juan Pablo Bello. He's an associate professor, music technology and electrical and computer engineering, and is the director of the Music and Audio Research Lab at NYU. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. It's great to be here.
I just want to note that the audio of a busy fall migration night in Ithaca, where we recorded that, was recorded by Bill Evans of Cornell, and we thank him. Juan, why do we do this? So we heard them describing that they're tracking the flight of the birds. Why is that important? Why are we doing that?
Well, I mean, there are many reasons why this is an interesting question to try to address. I mean, from a biological perspective, I mean, the larger process that the biologists in the project are interested on is that of understanding migratory patterns for bird species across the continental U.S. And specifically, they are looking at two things. I mean, the first one is to understand precisely the onset of the migration across the length of a season, and also to understand the composition, the species compositions of migratory flights that are start during that period of time. Now, right now, scientists use two sources of information for looking at this, trying to understand these patterns. The first one is coming from bird watchers. So it's a lot of people watching birds across the country. And Cornell has been very good at you know, gathering information from that community and being able to characterize, you know, the occurrence of species in certain geographical locations in time. But those observations are mostly made by day, and migrations often occur at night. So there is a scarcity of data at night, so there is no real good information coming about the migration itself from the observations. The other source of information is weather surveillance radar, but radar can only tell you something about the volume, the speed, and the direction of the migration, but it tells you nothing about the composition in a species type. So acoustic monitoring really gives you the missing piece of a puzzle here, you know, something that can tell you this is a species composition, but also can tell you very precisely when in time and in location this is happening.
You know, people are concerned now with there are now more wind farms and wind turbines around there killing birds. Could this be something that might prevent the death of the birds from that kind of stuff?
Most definitely. I mean, this is something that is certainly in our mind, you know, for further down the road. I mean, we believe that the ability to continuously monitor bird migrations and be specific about species migrating could really provide new information about the interaction between human activity and these biological processes. So basically, you know, if you have something like an early warning system that can tell you, well, you know, change you know, the pattern of wind turbine activation in this farm and this in the next 3 hours because you have this species flying by you, or, you know, maybe send an early warning to an airport or to a building near your city, you know, to change lighting on a given night, you know, that could have a big ecological impact, but also potentially a big economical impact.
I see that. Now, you're in the music school at NYU, right?
That's correct.
How does that connect to identifying birds? How did you put those two together?
Well, I mean, it's all about sound, and my real passion, I mean, music was the reason I got into this field in the first place. You know, I was a player. I grew in a very musical family, but also had an attitude for the more technical scientific side of things. So engineering was a way to reconcile these two aspects of my interest. And then, you know, for the last 15 years or so, we've been doing quite a lot of work on the music, analyzing patterns of sound in music. And over the last 2-3 years, we've been expanding that agenda to work with environmental sounds, birds for sure, but also things like urban noise environments and other types of environmental sounds from which we can apply some of the same techniques and gain some important information on.
Now, I want to give our listeners a taste of the challenges here, because people will tend to think, you know, you're trying to identify bird calls. This is not what is happening. We're not looking for the bird song that people are interested in. I'm going to play 4 different sounds here, and we'll identify the difference between the two. Those were?
Right. So what you heard there was a sequence of sounds from 4 different sources. So the first two, they are birds. And the first is swing song thrush, which is actually the species that we're trying to identify. The second one is a different species. It's a veery, a very similar call. The third one is actually not a bird at all. It's a frog. It's a spring peeper that happens to emit a call and a very similar, you know, time frequency pattern than the birds. The fourth one is an electromechanical sound actually coming from an alarm, you know, maybe a battery alarm in the sensor.
So,
you know,
car.
Yeah, that gives you a good idea of the complexity of the problem.
Yeah, let me play that again. I guess you missed it. Now that you know what to listen for, let's hear those 4 again. All right. That's the bird. So we're not listening to the warbler or the songs, and the computers are trying to pick out what is a bird call and what are those extraneous sounds.
Definitely.
That's the idea here.
Yeah, the idea is to pick up, you know, first to separate bird flight calls from everything else, you know, from all these other type of sources that might emit similar sounds, and then go a little bit further than that, you know, and even being able to tell you, you know, this is not only a bird call, but it's also this particular species.
And so how far have you gotten with this? How successful have you been?
Well, we already been working with data from 2 migratory seasons, from fall and spring of the last year. And, you know, we already have some preliminary systems which are doing some good identification for a couple of species under very, very difficult conditions. So right now we're collecting the data and developing the methods that will give you some classification, I hope, of around 10 different species by the end, but sometime in the fall.
And nothing is, as you say, you're still teaching the computer how to understand what it's hearing. When it makes a mistake, is it usually misidentifying one bird for another, or is it misidentifying what the birds are versus the other sounds?
Well, it's a mix of everything, right? So in that example that you play, you get, you know, a bit of an inkling for the type of errors that we make. I mean, like spring peepers, these frogs, that was the third call in the sequence that you play, you know, those were huge confusions in the last round of experiments that we run. That's something the biologists are very familiar with, you know, this confusion in between, you know, different type of biological families, you know, but as it happens, you know, this particular frog has a call that just fall under a very similar pattern that certain birds.
How are your detectors different from my phone listening to me and, you know, respond when I say, Siri, what is different about your detectors?
Well, so your phones, you know, the microphone in your phone and the system in your phone is really developed to work with a closed mic signal. So, you know, you have to speak very close to it. You know, it has to be a very high, what we call signal to noise ratio, meaning that your voice has to be much louder than the background environment in it. So, you know, picking sources and picking content on that signal is a fundamentally different problem than putting a microphone out there where you have a signal that is probably very, very far from the microphone itself. So it's a very, you know, a tenuous occurrence in the acoustic environment, and then you have all sorts of background conditions, you know, so noise from the wind, from rain, from other species, from human activity. Being able to pick these sounds in this very, very complicated and complex environment is really the challenge that, you know, your phone cannot address right now and that we're trying to address with this technology.
So you really have to work closely with the bird people to know what the sounds are so you can fine-tune the your receiver, right, the computer.
Well, I think that's definitely the plus of this collaboration. You know, this is what's exciting about what we have going on here. I mean, the team in Cornell, they really bring this in-depth expertise on ornithology, on birds, and on the different species, and in the environment that we're analyzing. That gives us definitely an edge in the way that we develop algorithms to be able to solve these problems.
And someday it's going to be an app for all of us, right, that we can leave out overnight, hear what's going on?
I hope so. I hope that we'll be developing something that will be, you know, of general, you know, available to the public at some point. But right now, there are very important research questions that we have to address. So that's the order of the day.
Thank you very much, Juan. Juan Pablo Bello is an associate professor of music technology and electrical and computer engineering. And he's director of the Music and Audio Research Lab at NYU and part of the BirdVox project there. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This year, we're celebrating Science Friday's 25th year on the air by recalling some of our golden oldies, traveling back in time to ideas we discussed decades ago, and see how they have panned out as predicted. And one thing we were talking about in the early 1990s was the future of electric cars, which were just starting to poke their hood ornaments above the horizon. And to promote their development, in 1992, the California Air Resources Board was pushing emission standards that only electric vehicles could satisfy. Automakers like Ford and GM were developing prototypes in response. And the recent energy crisis of the 1970s and 80s has raised interest in independence from petroleum fuels. So, on February 1992, I brought on several experts for a conversation about the car of the future. Would consumers soon be able to purchase an affordable, well-performing car that runs only on batteries? Well, what about other technologies like gasohol, hydrogen fuel cells, or even solar? It was an exercise first in peering into the future.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, which car is fairest of them all?
Though a gas guzzler in your driveway there be, in your future, an electric car I see.
Wait a minute, an electric car? Hey, come off it. You've got to lay off that glass wax, babe. Electric cars are the stuff of science fairs and cross-country rallies, even the post office.
Though batteries may now power some, the car for you will take years to come. Around the year 2002, I see an electric car for you.
And Robert Nichols, and I talked to James Warden, CEO of Solectria Solar, about his Solectria Force, a battery-powered vehicle he had developed at the time. I also talked to Dan Sperling, a civil and environmental engineer at the University of California, Davis, and Robert Nichols, manager of alternative fuels for Ford Motor Company. And here's more of that 1992 conversation, starting with James Warden's Solectria Force.
Would you describe for us the Solectria's electric car? What is it like?
We call it the Solectria Force, and it's a four-seat, three-door hatchback that's a state-of-the-art design car. It has a very efficient AC drive system with regenerative braking. And other things that make it much more efficient and practical.
Did you take a regular car and modify it?
The present car, the Solectria Force, is a Geo Metro shell, and we take out the motor, the gas motor, the transmission, and all the other related components, and put in our state-of-the-art drive system and a small battery pack that runs it.
You know, recently General Motors introduced its first electric muscle car called the Impact. That car, what, does 0 to 60 in 8 seconds.
Right.
Does your car go that fast?
Not quite. Ours gets to 30 in 8 seconds, which is plenty adequate for city driving, and it can go at up to 60 miles an hour handily.
No
it
kidding.
It doesn't get there in 8 seconds. It's definitely not a Porsche, but it will get you around town and it'll get on the highway when it needs to.
And what kind of batteries? Did you have to come up with new exotic types of batteries to run this?
No, that's kind of the key thing. We do use just a off-the-shelf battery.
A lead-acid battery?
Yes.
Like the kind you find in a regular car?
Yeah.
And you wire them all together to get enough juice to drive the motors?
They're all in series. There's 12 sort of medium-sized batteries in neat boxes underneath the hood, and one in the rear.
And the driving range is what?
60 to 80 miles normal driving.
And you recharge it at night in a regular outlet at home?
Yep, there's a plug. You just open the gas cap and you put an extension cord in there, and it charges it right up.
How does Ford look at something like this?
We think first application, first customer could well be fleets such as post office, floor shop, anybody doing intercity delivery.
Why isn't that someone who's going to the, you know, individuals who are going to the supermarket or taking their kids back and forth from school?
If you start with a vehicle, which is really a truck, although in this case small, it has a payload capacity. And when you build an electric vehicle, you add weight to the vehicle because of the battery pack. And when you start with a vehicle that has a payload capacity, you're not impacting the structural integrity of the vehicle as you would be if it were a derivative of an already existing passenger car.
Doesn't this effort to go to electric car, wouldn't it mean that we really have to change nationally the way we drive? Wouldn't it be better to have gas stations with rapid charging devices in them or rest stops where you could plug your car in to charge for an hour? I mean, wouldn't that be ideally the way to do it?
We would like that. That's part of an electric vehicle system, is providing the opportunity for recharging at work and other places.
But that also means when you build a highway, you have to build the sockets there for it. I mean, it's a really national effort to change the way we think.
That's true. But in fact, most of the recharging probably would be at home. And in fact, it's desirable that it be done at home because we want it to be done off-peak when there's a lot of extra electricity capacity.
So do you think eventually, by the turn of the century, the internal combustion engine is doomed? It's going to be a dinosaur?
Not at all. I think it's going to be around for quite a long time. These new technologies will come into the marketplace a lot slower than perhaps any of us want them to, but that there's a lot of inertia in the system out there.
That was Roberta Nichols, who has since passed away, and we've brought back, though, everyone else to talk about what's happened in the 24 years since that conversation. There's a lot of stuff that we talked about in there, some that was prescient, some that hasn't happened yet, and let's talk about it. Dan Sperling is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of California, Davis, founding director of its Institute for Transportation Studies. And he drives a hydrogen-powered fuel cell, electric car. Is that right, Dan?
That's right. And my wife has a battery electric car.
Wow. And James Warden is back. He's co-founder and CEO of Yaskawa Solectria Solar, which developed the Solectria Force. Welcome back, James.
Thank you. And I'm in a Solectria Force, and I didn't make it to the studio, but I'm on the side of the road here because the phone app died on me.
So what's in your car that ran out of electricity?
No, the car's doing great. It has 67% capacity left, and I'm all the way from Lawrence, Mass. To Boston.
Wow. You were just getting started on this Solectria Force when we talked in 1992. Give us an idea where it went from there.
Yeah, it expanded pretty quickly from that point with utility and fleet sales and some individual sales. mounting up to about 500 cars by the mid to late 1990s. But then when the California mandate went away in 99, it all kind of came to a grinding halt, which was unfortunate. But the cars worked very well.
And after the Force, you developed its successor, the Selectria Sunrise, in 1994. Why aren't we all driving them today?
Well, I guess because I didn't have the genius of Elon Musk to make a luxury car so you could afford to pay for the batteries and the equipment. You know, our goal always was to make a nice car for everyday people. And that was a tough one. Of course, the battery technology also wasn't as good, but that car could go 100 miles on lead acid and 200 on nickel metal hydride batteries. Today's lithium would take it 400 or 500 miles.
Mm-hmm. Dan, back in 1992, I introduced the show by calling electric vehicles, quote, the stuff of science fairs. And, you know, as James says, Tesla is a household name. Is it safe to say electric vehicles now are mainstream, Dan?
I wouldn't say they're quite mainstream, but they're definitely in the mix, and they're in a lot of people's consciousness. And I think I would say with complete confidence that we are going to move to almost completely electric drive vehicles in the coming decades.
Well, Roberta Nichols, I did say that in
1992 also.
Well, Roberta Nichols got right. It was that we would not be doing away with gasoline-powered cars anytime soon.
Well, yeah, I guess she was right in the end.
Yeah, we just had the date off a little bit, though, but we're clearly going to be phasing out the gasoline vehicles soon. That's my prediction.
It always seems that the battery is the hardest part of the equation to solve. Where do we need to go with batteries? You mentioned the lithium-ion battery, and what kind of battery technology do we need to make this, very easily saleable, cheaper price, longer distance?
I think we're essentially there already. The cost, just in the last few years, costs have come down dramatically, really. And now the car companies are just starting to build the vehicles around these new batteries. I mean, you can see Tesla's coming out with a $35,000 car with 200-mile range. General Motors is actually going to come out ahead of them later this year with a 200-mile car range at about the same price. So the battery costs are coming down. It's been an incremental process, is improving the chemistry a little, learning how to manufacture some of the scale-up technologies, and so I think we're pretty close there. The question really is the mix between having pure battery EVs, or are we going to use these plug-in hybrids like the Volt, or are we going to what extent are we going to use fuel cells?
Yeah, and that's my next question, because I know Toyota has fuel cell cars running around in California, right, James?
Yeah, there are low volume cars running for a while, but it always seems like it. I think, I don't know if Dan would agree, he's driving one. But don't they still really seem to be still a couple of decades off, like they always are? It seems like pure EVs, lithium batteries coming down quickly. Aluminum ion might be next, but even just lithium doubling down one more time in cost, it might be there. Fuel cells are cool, but making the hydrogen is very, very energy intensive and inefficient. And I think that's one of the big issues, plus the complexity of a fuel cell vehicle. But Dan, you're driving one. What's it like overall?
Well, driving it is a great experience. In fact, it's an electric car. It runs with electric motors. Right. The difference is that there's a fuel cell on board that converts hydrogen into electricity. So instead of a battery, you have a fuel cell. And really, that's a big selling point here, because as I did say, batteries are getting cheaper. But when you get into larger, like pickup trucks, SUVs, and bigger trucks, those batteries are still quite heavy and dense. And so there's still a challenge getting batteries into bigger vehicles. And that's probably where fuel cells will find its place. But even smaller vehicles, the question now is building out the hydrogen infrastructure, the hydrogen charge fueling stations.
Could you not build a flexible fuel chassis? You know, the body has got the electric motors in it for either batteries or fuel cells, and then choose which one you want to put in there and maybe bring the cost down that way.
Yeah, that's a good idea. could be almost a lot of the same equipment, and you just have the battery or the fuel cell. The one issue becomes the complexity or the difference of a battery is a block of stuff with some cooling system in it. The fuel cell needs the hydrogen tanks, the way to bring the hydrogen in, and then the fuel cell. And I don't know, Dan, maybe you have an idea how do those things package, because it seems like the batteries are all going for a flat deck under the passengers. Every car is being made that way by pretty much all the automakers, I think, except the Volt and the Bolt, which have the big bar going down the middle. But how would hydrogen tanks and fuel cells pack in a car chassis differently than electric?
Yeah, there's some packaging issues, but more you're talking about redundant systems or parallel systems, and that gets expensive and complicated.
Right.
I think with hydrogen, there's no reason. You can have a little battery that you can use just for regenerative braking, but there's really no reason to have a big battery. So I think the future is going to be, on the battery side, it's going to be pure battery EVs for shorter, smaller vehicles, you know, shorter range, and plug-in hybrids like the Volt for longer range trips and travel and people that need more flexibility. And then the hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are going to be essentially competing with the plug-in hybrids. And that's really that's the real question in my mind. Pure battery EVs, they're probably going to get 20% of the market, something like that. And then the question, what happens with the rest of the market?
I'm Ira Flato. Right. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about the future of car technology with Dan Sperling and James Warden. Back in 1992, we talked about the chicken and egg problem of putting in charging infrastructure before people owned fuel cell cars or vice versa. I mean, it looks like, as you pointed out, Elon Musk, he sort of did it both at the same time. And now we see that with at least the fuel cells, Toyota is quite slowly installing some of those charging stations for their hydrogen. So,
that is something where we, going back, it was pretty interesting. We were talking about chicken and egg, you know, way back in 92, but it was with ethanol. Now it is with hydrogen. And in California, the state of California is building out a network of about 100 stations. We're up to about 20, and many more are being built and opening up on a regular basis. And so the question is, some people say it's chicken and egg, but I think in this case, actually the stations need to be there first, because no one's going to buy one of those cars unless they know there's a hydrogen station near them.
Well, what do you think would have happened to make electric vehicles become popular faster in the last 24 years? And what if California had stuck to the guns and not weakened the mandate in 1999?
That's a magic question. I'll start with that one. I think that if the mandate had stuck, it would have been much faster. And I draw a direct parallel to the 30% solar photovoltaic tax credit, which is where we moved our technology for Yaskawa's Electric Solar. We took the inverter technology and made those inverters. It's supported by a 30% federal tax credit, which powers the whole thing. And now that tax credit need over the next 5 years will dwindle to nothing. If the California mandate had held, or there was a $7,500 tax credit, which is, to be honest, helping to power the EV explosion now, then back in 92, 94, 96, you know, 2000, it would definitely have happened way faster. But as soon as that mandate went away, all of our orders stopped. All the interest from the utilities, the government agencies dried up overnight. At the same time, the hybrids came, you know, this incremental, stepwise, halfway idea, which, you know, helped, but they could be sold normally without any subsidies, and they took over like wildfire, both the Honda and the Toyota hybrids of 1990, 1999, 2000, the Prius and the Insight.
We're going to take a break, and when we do, we're going to go back to the phones to 1992, what you predicted we might see on the roads and more. Plus, we're going to talk about why heat grounded a plane in Texas. Actually, it was Phoenix last week. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. In case you're just tuning in, we're talking this hour about the evolution of electric and other alternative fuels since we talked about it back in 1992 on a show on Science Friday. And this look back is part of our celebration of Science Friday's 25th anniversary. Wow. It doesn't feel like 25 years. So as often happens when we talk about vehicle technology on Science Friday, the phones ring as they were ringing in 1992, and they were hopping with insights and predictions from our listeners. Here are a few.
Okay, let's go to Madison, Wisconsin. Jesse in Madison.
Ah, good afternoon.
Yes.
I rode electric cars all the way to school because I rode the trackless trolleys in Cambridge. But my question is kind of a philosophical/scientific one I'd like to address to Dr. Sperling. When you say a zero-emission car, well, the electric car itself isn't emitting anything, but the coal-fired or hydro or nuke or whatever-powered electric plant that generates the electricity is definitely emitting something. And I'm curious how one goes about measuring the impacts per car when you count in transmission losses and all those kinds of things. Do you understand?
Yes, a terrific question. I mean, aren't you just moving the pollution from one place to another? The gist of what she's saying.
Yes, it's an excellent question. In fact, that's been the subject of substantial research programs of ours at UC Davis and elsewhere in the last couple of years. And what we're finding is looking at it as a total systems impact, systems analysis, is that as a general statement, electric vehicles do provide a major, unequivocally large air quality benefit. Now, to be more specific, what it does is essentially eliminates all carbon monoxide, about 98% of the carbon monoxide and 98% of the hydrocarbons relative to a comparable gasoline vehicle, provides major reductions in nitrogen oxides.
And we're not arguing that compared to a gasoline-powered car, it's reducing the pollution. We're just saying, well, aren't you moving that pollution to a coal-powered plant somewhere?
Yeah, well, these pollution numbers I'm telling you are from the power plant. Mm-hmm. And so you have to compare it to something. And what you want to compare it to is what is the alternative.
Okay, let's go to Dan in Racine, Wisconsin.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. And I was wondering why hybrid cars are not being considered. I had thought a company here in Milwaukee has done some...
You mean electric and gasoline power?
And another power source maybe on compressed natural gas. And I understand that in Denver they've even got a compressed natural gas station up and running right now.
Hybrid meaning what combination?
Some other power source.
And gasoline.
Possibly, or alcohol-fueled small engine.
Okay.
Along either parallel or in series with electric drive.
Dr. Sperling or Roberta Nichols?
Well, I'd like to speak to that. We are preparing some hybrid vehicles for the California Air Resources Board. One of the things that one has to consider in building a hybrid vehicle is you're now trying to put really two energy systems on board the vehicle, and so the engineering challenges just went up an order of magnitude trying to find room for a fuel tank and an engine as well as your battery mm-hmm. system. Mm-hmm. Even though maybe you don't need as much battery since you do have an engine on board. We are taking the approach, however, that the engine on board should be a range extender rather than a unit that can propel the vehicle independently. Because if you have an internal combustion engine on the vehicle where people can operate their vehicle on natural gas or methanol or whatever it is instead of the battery, that's what they're going to tend to do because that's what they're used to doing.
Gotcha. Okay, Ted in Nebraska, go ahead.
Yes, I'm a Midwestern farmer, and since the mid-70s, I've been eagerly awaiting the development of a renewable energy market for crops that I grow. And I was wondering if Dr. Sperling would compare the economics of ethanol production to other alternative fuels.
What kind of crops do you grow?
I raise corn and soybeans, and there's a potential for, ethanol production from corn and then possibly fuel oils from various oil seeds that we grow.
Let's ask Dr. Sperling quickly. We're getting close to the end. What do you think?
Quickly, making ethanol from corn is more expensive than any of the options except for hydrogen. And so there's probably not much enthusiasm for it. The real enthusiasm when you talk about renewable fuels should be and is with converting cellulosic material, like wood-type materials, into ethanol. You can do that. There's a lot more of it. You can grow it with much higher yields, and you can do it with lower cost. Mm. So that's where the real future is for renewable fuels. It's not with corn.
Not
I'm
corn.
Sorry.
Well, Dan Sperling is still here with us 24 years later. It's still corn, isn't it?
alas, it is still corn, and I'm still saying the same thing about cellulose now, cellulosic materials. That has been, of all the changes since then, where we have more hope or less hope, that's the one that's been continues to be frustrating.
Yeah.
The batteries are much better. We've made tremendous progress with vehicle technology generally, with fuel cells, but those cellulosic biofuels, they've been a struggle.
Well, we'll have you back 24 years from now, okay? And we'll all sit around and talk about where we thought it was going and where it did go. Dan Sperling, professor of civil environmental engineering at the University of California, Davis, and James Warden, co-founder and CEO of Yaskawa Solectria Solar. Thanks again. Thanks for traveling back in time with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ira.
Have a safe drive home. Last weekend, a United Airlines flight to Phoenix was forced to turn around and head back to Houston. The culprit behind the diversion? Nothing wrong with the plane. It was extreme heat. And that got us wondering, how does heat affect airplane flight? Is it as simple as air being less dense? That would really matter that much, since airplanes routinely fly at high altitudes where the air's already thin. And then there's a question also of climate change. As the world heats up, might there be new weight restrictions and other inconveniences for the airline industry? Marilyn Smith is professor and associate director at Georgia Tech's Vertical Lift Center of Excellence in Atlanta. Welcome to Science Friday. Are you there, Marilyn? Paul Williams is a Royal Society University Research Fellow in the Department of Meteorology at the University of Reading in the UK. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira.
I guess it's a busy day for you folks over there in the UK today.
Yeah, I guess we might talk about turbulence in a minute in the context of aviation, but it's been a pretty turbulent day on other fronts right over here.
Have we got Marilyn? Marilyn, yeah. Are you there? Oh, good. Dr. Smith, how does heat affect flights taking off or landing?
Well, it's a multifaceted approach. There are implications on the vehicle itself, but primarily the impact is on the engine. When you're having heat, what happens to the atmosphere is that the gas, and therefore, for an engine in particular, when you're trying to get the mass flow rate through the engine, you're not getting as much oxygen to make the fuel burn as efficiently. So since your engine isn't working as efficiently, then it has to work harder. The temperature inside the engine increases. In addition, the temperature outside is hot, and so you reach maximum levels of temperature in the engine. You have to pull it back. It's called derating. You don't run it at its optimum temperature, and therefore you lose your thrust. When you lose your thrust, then what happens is you either have to go faster or you have to have a longer runway.
Wow.
And so, you know, you can't take off in as efficiently, and you also have to look at your rate of climb. If you have some mountains at the end of that runway, then you're not going to climb as fast on a hot day, and so you have to be careful with that. You don't want to hit those mountains.
So by having a lot thinner air, it's harder for you're effectively raising the altitude the plane is sitting at, right?
Absolutely.
So at 120 degrees, like it was in Phoenix, what altitude would that be?
Well, Phoenix is at about approximately 1,100 feet altitude. At 120 degrees, the airplane thinks it's at a little over 5,000 feet altitude.
I think it's in Denver.
Close, yes.
Something like that.
Yes.
Wow. Paul Williams, as the world heats up in certain places, making waves more extreme, for example, due to climate change, how do you see that affecting operations at airports, flight restrictions, stuff like that?
Yeah, well, we do have evidence now that the number of weight restriction days has increased at least four U.S. airports since 1980. A weight restriction day is a day when planes cannot take off without removing either passengers or cargo from the plane in order to reduce the weight. because as the temperature increases, the density of the air on the runway decreases, decreasing the lift force on the wings of a plane. And of course, that makes it more difficult for it to take off.
So we have had occasions where the passengers have been bumped because it was too hot to fly?
Yeah, it happens right now, not very often, but the projection is that we'll see an increase in the number of days, and it's always in summer, the number of summer days, an increase in the number of summer days when there's a weight restriction, increasing projected by between 50 and 200% in the coming decades as the globe continues to warm.
My goodness. Marilyn Smith, what's the solution here? Do you think we can just design planes with equipment built to withstand temperatures 140, 150 degrees Fahrenheit, or are there certain physical limitations that we're bumping up against?
No, absolutely. In fact, we in the aerospace community have been dealing with this for the past decade. We are designing new engines that are not only able to be more efficient, saving us that fuel so that we don't dump out the carbon dioxide and the other pollutants out in the atmosphere that causes this rise in the temperature, but we're also working on having more efficient engines. We have new aircraft designs. We're not going to see the same old tube and wing designs of today. They're going to be much, much more efficient. We want to decrease the need for the runway lengths, not interestingly because of the temperature, but because of noise restrictions. So we are looking at decreasing our runway requirements significantly, like 10 to 50% in some instances. So I think that's not going to be a problem. You know, our aircraft today can actually operate over 120 degrees Fahrenheit. They can go up higher. It's just, you have to have certain equipment.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Marilyn Smith and Paul Williams, who are talking about the heat affecting airline flights. Paul, let's talk about the other side of the equation, and that is the airport itself. I mean, we have rising sea levels. I remember when we have storms now, it was Sandy and other storms, but they put JFK and LaGuardia underwater, and you have LAX, which is on the other coast on the sea.
Yeah, that's right. Many airports around the world are sufficiently high above sea level that they don't need to worry about this. So Heathrow Airport in London, for example, is 25 meters above sea level. But other airports, San Francisco International and JFK, are only 4 meters above sea level. And actually, there are some airports around the world that are below sea level. So, for example, Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam is 3 meters below sea level. And believe it or not, there is an airport in Kazakhstan that is 22 meters below sea level. This is a large commercial airport. Of course, it's far inland. But it could be that coastal airports that are low-lying could be threatened in future by a combination of sea level rise and storms and tides.
What about the flight itself? All right, now we've talked about taking off, landing in the airport. Now you're on the plane and you're flying. How is your flight going to be affected, Dr. Williams?
Well, that's a great question. Let me give you an example. The prevailing winds on transatlantic flight routes are expected to be significantly stronger by the end of the century, perhaps 15% stronger as the climate changes. And that's because the winds and the temperatures are very strongly coupled together by the fluid dynamics of the atmosphere. And because we're changing the temperatures, the winds are changing as a consequence. What this means is that eastbound flights will experience stronger tailwinds. And we've calculated that this is going to double the likelihood of a transatlantic plane crossing the Atlantic in less than 5 hours and 20 minutes. Of course, on the other hand, it means that westbound flights will experience stronger headwinds, and that's going to slow down those flights. We've calculated that it's going to double the likelihood of a westbound flight across the Atlantic taking more than 7 hours. And it's possible that these changes are already happening. Huh. The first thing I do when I get into my office every morning is I check out the jet stream. You can watch it in real time on the internet. And about 18 months ago, in January 2015, it was blowing at speeds of 250 miles an hour. And we know that an eastbound flight from New York to London took only 5 hours and 16 minutes. And that broke the record for the fastest non-Concorde crossing. And on the other hand, there were westbound flights from London to New York that took so long that two planes which had taken off from London with what would normally be enough fuel to reach New York. They got as far as Maine and they realized that they weren't going to reach New York. They didn't have enough fuel because the headwinds were so strong that the journey had taken so long. So in fact, they had to make unscheduled refueling stops in Maine. I think we'll see a lot more record-breakingly fast eastbound flights and record-breakingly slow westbound flights in future as the climate continues to change.
What about turbulence? Anything different there?
And another consequence of a stronger jet stream, as you say, is more turbulence. And we've been calculating that there could be twice as much clear air turbulence on transatlantic flights by the middle of this century. And I've seen statistics showing that the number of accidents caused by turbulence has grown by a factor of 5 since 1980. That's 3 times faster than the growth in air traffic. Now, it's too early at this stage to blame that on climate change, but the science is clearly telling us to expect a long-term upward trend in turbulence in the coming decades.
Well, Dr. Smith, we'll watch for those new airplanes coming out, able to handle the new vicissitudes of the new normal. I want to thank you for both taking time to be with us today. Marilyn Smith, Professor and Associate Director at Georgia Tech's Vertical Lift Center of Excellence in Atlanta. Paul Williams, Royal Society University Research Fellow, Department of Meteorology at the University of Reading in the UK. Thank you for both taking time, as I say, to be with us today. Have a good weekend.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You too.
You're welcome. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. You want to write us? We'd love to get your comments the classic way. Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can also email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Also, we've got all this great cephalopod stuff up. We've got last day of cephalopod week up on our website at sciencefriday.com. All kinds of great videos and pictures and all kinds of stuff, including the knitted hats. There's something else. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.